Good afternoon. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. And this is Ozarks at Large for a gray day, Tuesday, October 27th, 2020. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ahead this hour, we're a week away from Election Day. And Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda explains how a new hotline can help with voter intimidation claims, and she'll introduce us to another new voter in 2020. And in our second half hour, John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, considers what the large early vote numbers might mean for results next week. There are 530 new confirmed and 82 new probable cases of COVID-19 in Arkansas, according to the State Department of Health's most recent numbers. The ADH is reporting 21 additional deaths. Hospitalizations increased by 16 patients in the most recent 24-hour testing period. There are now 649 Arkansans in hospitals because of complications from the virus. That's the most ever hospitalized at once since the start of the pandemic. The top five counties for new cases: Pulaski, Washington, Craighead, Sebastian, and Benton. A report from Northwest Arkansas hospitals last night indicates there are 55 patients in COVID-19 units in Washington and Benton County. That's two fewer than were hospitalized Friday. The report counts 19,114 cumulative cases in the two counties since March. Governor Asa Hutchinson appeared on Face the Nation on CBS Sunday. He was interviewed by Margaret Brennan about the state of the COVID-19 pandemic in Arkansas and remarks made by President Donald Trump. Earlier this month, Governor Hutchinson said he supports the president's reelection despite misgivings about the president's messaging on the coronavirus. Brennan asked the governor about the record-high numbers of hospitalizations in the state and the spiking infection rate. Arkansas is one of 15 states that have added more cases in the past week than any other seven-day stretch. The governor says it's a concerning statistic.
I do think people who get ill want to go into the hospital quicker because they can start their treatment. They have a better chance of recovery. And so I think that is a little bit of a factor. Right now, our hospitalization space is tight. We have adequate space, but we watch it very carefully. And the spike in cases that we've seen is a concern. I think it reflects what we're all looking at nationwide in terms of going into the winter, combination of flu, the combination of more indoor settings. And so it is concerning, and we're making preparations for it. But we have to really pull together to follow the guidelines that are necessary to keep the economy moving, but at the same time, make sure we don't increase that spread.
As he's done in the past, Governor Hutchinson stressed Arkansans have the individual responsibility to pull together and follow masking and social distancing guidelines. Brennan asked the governor whether he feels the president is undermining that messaging by not encouraging mask wearing himself.
Well, it makes it confusing. I mean, he's made it very clear that wearing a mask is important. I saw him wear a mask going into the polls yesterday. But obviously, with the rallies, there is confusing messages there. The president, leaders in crisis, always needs to do two things. One is to be truthful and realistic. And everyone knows that we are going through a very difficult crisis, and it's going to likely get worse as we go into the winter. Mm-hmm. Secondly, you've got to give the American people hope, and that is the vaccine that the administration is working incredibly hard for. I spoke with Secretary Azar this week, talking about the partnership with the states and vaccine distribution. And so they're working hard at the White House level, but the communication as to what we need to do is an important part of it as well.
I want to ask you about that.
Governor Hutchinson is scheduled to provide his weekly coronavirus response briefing this afternoon from Little Rock, beginning at 1:30. You can watch it live on his YouTube channel or listen to it right here on 91.3 KUAF. And the Bella Vista Library has something this week it hasn't had in a while: patrons inside. The library's new hours are now 9 to 1 and 2 to 4, Monday through Thursday. There is a limit to how many patrons can be inside at one time. On Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, 20 people can look for books at the same time. On Tuesdays, a day reserved for people considered high risk for contracting the virus, capacity is limited to 5 people at a time. Masks or face shields are required. No food or drink will be allowed inside. This is Ozarks at Large. The Democratic Party of Arkansas is launching a Spanish language voter protection hotline to assist all Arkansas voters during the election season. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more.
The public announcement of the new Spanish language initiative comes about a week after the Democratic Party of Arkansas announced the launch of an English language voter protection hotline. Manuel Tejada, vice chairman of the Arkansas Democratic Hispanic Caucus, says the goal of the hotline is to be a resource for all Spanish-speaking voters.
In the past, there have been complaints that there are people maybe trying to intimidate voters, harassing voters, people that have questions that the poll workers may not have the response at the moment. So we wanted to create something that would, number one, just give people access to that information. But two, with the Spanish speaking hotline, you know, that's another thing where the state has done a very poor job of giving access to information that isn't in English.
Tejada says while some Spanish speakers can also speak English, they may not be able to read it. In Arkansas, ballots are not presented in Spanish, but you are allowed to take a translator with you to the polls.
You're allowed to have a translator there with you. Unfortunately, you can't have a single translator at the polling location. They're not allowed to just like hang out and translate for everybody. According to the state law, one translator is only allowed to translate for five people.
Michael John Gray, chairman of the Democratic Party of Arkansas, says although Arkansans can have a translator when voting, finding one can be a barrier to casting a ballot.
So not only do you have to find a translator, you've got to find someone that can go with you when you can vote, and you got to hope they haven't taken five people already. So there are huge roadblocks to voting. There are a lot of things that need to be made easier across the board. But for segment of the population that English isn't their first language, these are no-brainers, and not to address them, you would think there'd be some underlying reasons that aren't in logic, frankly.
Since launching the hotlines earlier this month, officials say they've received more than 200 calls in English and about a dozen in Spanish. Gray says the DPA always intended to set up a Spanish-speaking hotline, but they first wanted to make sure they had a dedicated line and enough people to staff it.
We have staff and volunteers who head up our voter protection team. And then we have volunteers who are helping answer the phones, volunteer attorneys around the state that'll help if there are issues. So it is we're dedicating resources, money and staff to it, but also a host of volunteers.
Gray says more than 200 volunteers are helping with both hotlines, which are in operation whenever the polls are open to about an hour after polls close. Voters can also leave a voicemail if they call after hours. Gray says the DPA intends to keep an informational hotline available to Arkansans once the election is over.
Just it isn't an election issue. It is a what about candidates or how to become registered to vote or impediments to registering to vote. And there are a lot of nonprofits, especially up in your part of the world, that are doing this work, and the party should also be one of those alternatives. So it is our intent to keep some form of, it won't be a election day hotline or voting season hotline, but to keep some form of communication availability there.
Manuel Tejada, vice chairman of the Arkansas Democratic Hispanic Caucus, says it's important for Spanish-speaking voters to have access to election information because the 2020 general election is an important one.
This is a historic election in Arkansas for Latinx voters, not only because of the nature of the race, but also because we have more Latinx candidates than we've ever had in the history of Arkansas.
You can access the Spanish language hotline by calling 501-299-5460. To reach the English language hotline, call 501-299-5589. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Early voting numbers in Washington County continue to outpace early voting numbers from 2016. Through last night, according to Jennifer Price, Washington County Election Coordinator, there are roughly 13,000 more early votes cast this year in the county than the previous presidential election cycle. Monday's gap was the smallest. Yesterday, an increase of about 900 compared to the second Monday of 2016. The highest number of early voters so far, people between the ages of 55 and 64, just more than 7,000 have already filled out a ballot. Early voters in the two youngest demographics tracked, those between a combined 18 and 34, account for more than 9,800 early votes. And a new location for early voting in 2020, Bud Walton Arena, attracted almost 2,000 voters in 2 days, Thursday and Friday.
For some, the election of 2020 is significant because it will be the first time they're casting a ballot in a presidential election. This week, we'll hear from members of the University of Arkansas community telling us, in their own words, how they're casting their ballot and why voting is important to them.
I am Leah Uribe. I am a professor at the University of Arkansas Music Department, and I'm also a practicing artist in the area and an activist. I fight for social justice. I'm from Colombia and have been in the United States for 20 years. I became a citizen of the United States in 2018 with the intention of voting in these presidential elections. It's such an honor and an opportunity, and I think a voice that is needed, not only for me, but also for the communities that I represent. So I'm very excited about voting for the first time for a presidential election, and I hope everybody is doing the same. In my family, we decided to do the mail voting, so I got my ballot, and I am in the process of scheduling my visit to the place where I am going to deposit it in person. That is going to happen today or tomorrow. My family was very political. Actually, some of my uncles were, part of the government at some point and very active in their realms. So I understood a little bit about politics growing up, but also how people are attached to parties and ideologies because they have very strong reasons to do so in their family history. And so I departed from our view somehow, trying to explore from a more objective way what were the options I had in front of me. And I have carried that interest through my life. But this idea of being politically active in the United States just came with that opportunity to vote, obviously. And became more real. So my passion for it and my knowledge of it was amplified by that opportunity to vote. We are so divided these days, and I think that the only option we have to be heard is to use that very same mechanism of voting, express our voice and trust that our voice is going to be accounted for. And once we feel that we're taking into consideration that we are an active part of these decisions, then we can, assume the consequences and continue working together. I just want to invite everybody to go vote. And I know it's an extra step. I know the circumstances are dire because of COVID and because of fear and because of the weather. And there are many reasons why it would be safer to stay at home. But really, I invite everybody to exercise this right. And also, reflecting on how many other countries do not have, or citizens of other countries do not have that opportunity to be heard in a transparent and candid way. So I invite everybody to exercise that right.
Election Day is November 3rd, but early voting is underway across Arkansas. Contact your local county clerk's office to find out when, where, and how you can cast your vote.
We are halfway through the 2020 fall semester, and the numbers are in for college enrollment during COVID-19, and they're not distributed equally. While a report from the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center shows that undergraduate enrollment is down across the board, community colleges are taking the biggest hit, with a 7.5% drop nationally. Northwest Arkansas Community College in Bentonville reported last month that student enrollment fell by 12% compared to 2019. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth recently spoke with Vice President of Student Services Todd Kitchen to learn what those figures mean for the school moving into 2021.
And Todd, can you just give me kind of a snapshot of the college's enrollment for 2020 compared to last year?
Sure. Our fall enrollment, we came in with 7,583 students compared to 8,649 students the previous fall.
Right. And so where is that dip coming from, with COVID-19, but who's being most impacted by that? Is it first-year students, transfer students, younger, older?
It's a combination, and that's a great question. Our first-year students, our new freshmen, that population was down roughly 500 fewer freshmen than the previous year. And then the other losses were spread across transfer students and returning students.
Because nationally, there is this trend that community colleges have been affected more by COVID-19 than four-year colleges. Where do you think that's coming from? Why do you believe that is?
Part of that challenge is community colleges historically have served a large population, but we know we have a very distinct mission that focuses on underserved populations. So when you look at the socioeconomics and look at the demographics that have been impacted by COVID-19, many of the populations that we historically serve have been impacted. So now you have financial strain, housing security strains, food security, and things of that nature. And I think that is what is really the driver behind the community college enrollment taking as much of a negative hit as we've seen this year, this past year.
And then as far as fees and finances, have you had to increase fees or in enrollment cost, anything like that?
So right now, no, we have not. And I will tell you, one of the things that the community colleges have benefited from is the ability to access some funds from the federal government, some COVID relief funds, and even to be able to give some of those funds directly to our students. So as of now, no, we haven't had to increase our cost for our students to continue their educations.
And on finances, can you just kind of break down for me how that's looking throughout the rest of this year and then into the future, just kind of where some of those, the federal grants or money is coming from and or state money?
Yeah, so the federal grants, the money that we received earlier in the year, we had access to those funds, but those funds have to be expended by December 31st. We don't know what the outlook of those funds will look like and the availability of those funds will look like into the next year. I think the community colleges are successful because we remain nimble. We've remained very fluid. So we have been able to address certain things to reprioritize, reallocate funds and things of that nature that will certainly get us through the current fiscal year, the current budget year. But we will have to work hard to address the enrollment, declining enrollment, and certainly work hard to reverse that trend so that it does not have an economic impact on the community college long term.
And so what percentage of the fall classes are online right now?
I would say roughly 90% are online, 10% are face-to-face.
And then is that going to change coming up in the spring semester or into next fall?
So this is a difficult task. I would say right now, safely with the spring semester, you will see a similar approach. We are looking for ways to increase those face-to-face offerings. However, it's a delicate balance because we have to maintain our standards of safety. So again, I think you will see an increase gradually into the spring of more face-to-face offerings, more increases by the summer, and certainly, if all goes well, would like to see more traditional face-to-face offerings by fall of 2021.
And are you seeing similar trends in enrollment with workforce development or adult and continuing education?
Actually, since the beginning of this crisis, the workforce development training has just skyrocketed. As a matter of fact, I was visiting with our dean of workforce development, who shared with me they have offered over 13,812 hours of online training. Their retail and supplier training and certificate programs have increased over 80% during this crisis. So where you see the traditional credit degree seeking transfer programs in decline, on the workforce side of the house, their numbers are actually growing at a very steady rate.
And then as far as staff, faculty, if you had to let people go, what's the temperature there?
Yeah, so again, because of good budgeting, because of good financial resources made available through some COVID packages and whatnot from the federal government, we have not had to let people go. We are not in a hiring freeze. Certainly, we are watching our expenditures, but it has not, from a personnel standpoint, forced us to do anything negatively with our personnel.
And then looking ahead, how do you feel about enrollment for the upcoming for 2021?
I consider myself a conservative optimist, so I am hopeful as we are able to increase the face-to-face offerings in a safe way that we can, again, reverse this trend or change the direction of this trend and begin growing our enrollment once again. I think it's important to point out our faculty and staff. So all of the world is in the middle of navigating this pandemic. Our faculty and staff, as human beings, are navigating these very tumultuous times while continuing to teach and provide services for our students. And I think that's what makes community colleges and other institutions very special. The heart of what we do is the people that are committed to their important work.
That was Todd Kitchen from the Northwest Arkansas Community College Student Services speaking with Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth. You can hear all the stories on Ozarks at Large when you'd like. Our daily shows are available as a podcast. You can download or subscribe for free by going to wherever you get your podcasts already. And if you'd like to hear the most recent show, just ask your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large. And of course, you can always go to ozarksatlarge.com to listen to and share stories and complete shows.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Mockingbird Kitchen, locally owned and operated with indoor dining and curbside pickup Wednesday through Sunday. Modern Ozark dishes, local brews, spirits, and online ordering available. Following COVID safety procedures, mockingbirdkitchen.com for more information. KUAF is supported by Mockingbird Kitchen, locally owned and operated with indoor dining and curbside pickup Wednesday through Sunday. Modern Ozark dishes, local brews, spirits, and online ordering available. Following COVID safety procedures, mockingbirdkitchen.com for more information.
This is Ozarks at Large. Thanks for being with us on this Tuesday. These are big days for a political writer. The run-up to an election is perhaps the time when a pundit or prognosticator works the hardest, until the days immediately after an election, of course, when analysis can move into another gear. This week, John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and Roby Brock, with our partner Talk Business and Politics, mull over what the last week before Election Day holds for Arkansans and Americans in 2020.
We are seeing huge numbers of people voting early. They clearly want to be on the record. You voted early.
First day of early voting.
So that in case you die between
now and election. I didn't want to die and not get counted.
But we're seeing like big numbers in Florida. We're seeing big numbers in Texas in particular. Texas, what does all of this, when you read the tea leaves on this, what does this all this tell you?
Well, that's the question I've been asked. Is this just a matter of more people voting, or is it the same general presidential election electorate, but wanting to vote early because of concerns about the virus, or just fired up and want to make sure they get counted? I think it's all of that. I think interest is greater in this election than in 2016, and maybe the biggest since 08 when Obama had the great inspirational coalition working. But I think beyond that, it's more a matter right now of people who might normally wait till Election Day don't want to, either because they're just anxious to get it done. I had a guy in line tell me, I'm voting today. This was the first day of early voting at Fletcher Library in Midtown Little Rock. He just thought, I need to know. I'm voting today so I can disengage. That's what he actually said. You know, then
there's some truth to that.
And then there,
it's done. There's nothing that's going to change your vote or your mind after this. So,
and the Texas early voting has been massive. Mm-hmm. I mean, you haven't asked, but this whole Texas thing, is Texas truly in play for the Texans, Texas Democrats, to compete for the state house? And maybe there's a Dallas Morning News poll yesterday has Biden up by 4 over Trump in the state of Texas. And then you think, well, going against the oil industry would probably affect that. But that's the early voting is so enormous, that cake may be baked. And Kamala Harris, I read, is going to go to Dallas on Friday. Is that because they have a chance to win, or because they want to make Trump spend some money down there to hold it so that he can't spend it in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania? Probably the latter, because there's a lot of chess that goes on. Even so, everything looks cooked for the Democrats. This is their election, which is what worries me more than anything else.
Let's talk about what's going on in the second congressional district. This race still appears to be heading into the last week of the campaign, neck and neck. Some people would say conventional wisdom is French Hill still has a slight advantage because he can run up those numbers outside of Pulaski County. I'm not so sure that Joyce Elliott might not set a record for turnout in Pulaski County. That's the thing I'm kind of watching. 60% has kind of been the conventional wisdom of how a Democrat can do here. What if she exceeds 60%? That changes the outcome of that race.
That's what this is all about, largely. Well, no, it's not what it's all about, but largely about. She, because of who she is and the campaign she's running, and also because of aversion to Trump and enablers, perceived enablers such as Hill, that's what's going, and the turnout of a liberal base in Pulaski County, African-American voters, is possibly going to be beyond anything we've seen, and we've seen large ones before, presidential races, or 2 years ago with Frank Scott elected mayor, helping drive up Clark Tucker's numbers. The early voting lines and just the sense that you get is that it's bigger this time. And yeah, but that's not everything for her. She has to get more votes than usual, a higher percentage, more votes than usual for a Democrat in Pulaski County. And then she needs to hemorrhage a little less outside of Pulaski County, which means she needs out there to get some of these suburban and rural women who seem to be leaning to her, giving her a little more vote than, say, Tucker got. She needs to hold that. That's how she does it. Hill's job is just to remind all the natural conservatives outside Little Rock she's a liberal, and he and the national groups are going to spend the next several days telling you that. In case you don't know it already, they're getting ready to tell you that.
I've seen an ad or two to that.
There's going to be. So. We're going to have the full battleground district experience in media this week.
Yeah.
It will be a barrage.
I'm looking forward to it.
Are you?
Yeah, I am. It's nice to kind of be in the mix and not be.
To be relevant.
Bored, you know? I mean.
But there is a point at which it becomes too much, you know?
You're not too hot and too cold. You're just right.
I'm just right.
Yeah.
All right.
John Brummett is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and he talked with Roby Brock with our partner Talk Business and Politics. There is more from their conversation, including John Brummett's take on issues 1, 2, and 3 that are on the Arkansas ballot at talkbusiness.net. In just a few minutes on our show, another usual Tuesday guest, the Militant Grammarian, is with us from the past. We'll hear again our conversation from 2019 about Halloween, monsters, things that go bump in the night, and language. Catherine Shirls and I have new conversations about language and grammar ready for you beginning next Tuesday. But our 2019 discussion is ahead in about 3 minutes. First, when a global pandemic was declared last March, crochet artist Gina Galena began to hook the coronavirus, looping yarn to create sculpture resembling microscopic images of COVID-19. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich caught up with her wearing one of her hand-embroidered masks on the streets of downtown Fayetteville to bring us this audio postcard about Galena's endeavor, accompanied by a feisty mockingbird.
I'm Gina Galena. I'm a crochet artist, crochet enthusiast, crochet addict, and I pretty much crochet anything that comes to mind. I have put my crochet wraps and items on different places, buildings, trees, chairs, people, light posts, benches, bicycles, crocheted walls, murals, I mean, just about anything. My wraps are temporary, and they've been placed at Maxine's in Fayetteville. They've been in Eureka Springs, Chicago, Las Vegas, Seattle, New York City. Well, I decided to crochet the coronavirus because I like to crochet with the times. I crocheted the little virus from a photo from the news, and I made a little handbag. I was dropping off some items to my friend, and as a joke, I just whipped a one up. So as time went on, I was like, okay, this is actually serious. This is not really a joke. And though a lot of people use humor to deal with reality, in which I do, so the toilet paper was flying off the shelves. So I said, well, let me do a crocheted coronavirus toilet paper cover. So as we're getting deep into the coronavirus and places are shutting down and I'm scared to death and I'm worried, and so I crocheted the coronavirus dress. You know, it's just a way to deal. I crocheted a bee outfit for a long time ago for me to, you know, lose my fear of bees. So it's just kind of a way to connect to the reality of what's going on when something's so scary and That's kind of why I did it. I think that everyone should definitely take this serious, but if you're an artist or a crafter or somebody, you need to deal with reality. We need to deal with what's happening. And the best way to deal with these things is to make art with it. Art is expression. It's your feelings, you know? Put your feelings and your fears and your worries and your humor and put it all in it and give it out to the people so we can all identify with it.
This is Ozarks at Large, and with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Catherine Shurls. How are you, Catherine?
I'm good. Kyle, I love Halloween for the drama and creativity. When the weather is good, I like to find a place on Dixon Street to watch the parade of costumes.
Yep.
Because there's some very weird and wonderful stuff there. There's so many traditions associated with Halloween. Let's look into the origins of some of them. And, of course, I've created a quiz for you.
Fantastic.
I suppose there are people who find the spookiness of Halloween scary. What do you call a fear of Halloween? Is it Wiccaphobia, Samhainaphobia, Nyctophobia, or Plasmophobia?
Well, I can't do any sort of logic here whatsoever. I'm going to go with Wiccaphobia.
Nope.
No.
And the reason you can't is because you, like I, did not know that Halloween can be traced back to Samhain. S-A-M-H-A-I-N.
Did not know that.
It's an ancient Celtic harvest festival honoring the Lord of the Dead.
Okay.
So Samhainophobia is a fear of Halloween. Yeah. Samhain also marked the beginning of the Celtic New Year. Because it was the time of transition between the old and the new, the Celts believed that the souls of those who had died during the previous year traveled together to the land of the dead. And it was also a time when those who had died before returned to visit their homes. Some people disguised themselves in masks and costumes so that the visiting spirits would not recognize them. They didn't want to mess with the dead.
I get you.
The word mask made a trip through French, my mask, from Italian mascara, and perhaps from the Latin masca, meaning evil spirit or witch.
Hmm.
So that's where witches came
from.
Okay. Kyle, what was the observance called before it was the modern day Halloween? Was it All Saints Day or All Souls Day?
I'm going to say it's All Saints Day.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was called also called All Hallows Day. It began at sundown on October 31st. The word Halloween is actually a shortened version of All Hallows Even, mm-hmm. the eve of All Hallows Day. At some point, people began referring to All Hallows Eve as Halloween. Do you remember Halloween having an apostrophe
I've
in it?
I've seen it.
Yeah, between the W-E and the mm-hmm. E-N, and then they dropped the apostrophe. And do you know the collective term for the day before Halloween through 2 days after? This is very, very common these days.
October 30th through November 2nd?
Actually,
That set has?
A collective name.
That's not De los Muertos.
Día de los Muertos. Los Días, plural.
Yes.
De los Muertos,
yes.
Yeah. This is a time when families fondly remember the deceased and participate in various festivals. By the way, I'm going to New Braunfels, Texas this year to see the Day of the Dead Festival.
Oh, good for you.
Kyle, what are you likely to see a lot of on porches around this time of year?
Jack-o'-lanterns.
Yeah, and when they're made of what?
Pumpkins.
Yeah. What were jack-o'-lanterns carved from before they used pumpkins?
Ooh.
Potatoes, turnips, apples, or onions?
What's big in Ireland? Because you're going back to the cell. I'm going to say
potatoes are, but no, turnips.
Okay, well,
good logic.
Thank you.
Didn't work. Jack-o'-lanterns, also jack-a-lanterns, originated in the British Isles with a large turnip or other vegetable rather than a pumpkin. The original meaning of the word jack-o'-lantern was night watchman or man with a lantern. But it took on the Halloween sense in 1837, first in Nathaniel Hawthorne's Twice Told Tales. Irish immigrants brought the jack-o'-lantern custom to North America, where that's when pumpkins were first used.
And, you know, once you get past the Wizard of Oz, one of the main characters in Frank L. Baum's other Oz books is a walking pumpkin-headed jack-o'-lantern.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Which to me has always been so frightening.
Oh, gosh, yes.
What do you think people first use bonfires for?
Oh, boy, this seems like something bad, like burning witches or something.
Kind of in the name, bonfire, a little bit. Take bon and add a letter to the end of it.
Bones, yes, a bonfire. I had heard that. Yes, a bonfire.
A bonfire comes from words bone and fire, fire of bones, and originally indicated a large open-air fire on which bones were burnt, either as a ceremony, like a funeral, or for burning heretics or banned books. Mm. The Halloween bonfires were lit to scare away evil spirits. Kyle, here's some things we learned from watching scary movies as kids.
Okay.
Where is Transylvania? I've got a choice.
Well, there's one in Kentucky, but that doesn't count.
Do you want the choice?
Yes.
Hungary, Scotland, Romania, nowhere, it's made up.
It's either Hungary or Romania, and I think I'm going to go with Romania.
Mm-hmm, that's right. What would be most useful if a werewolf attacked you? A gun with silver bullets, a cross, or to hide out until daylight?
Well, hiding out till daylight is not bad, but if you've got a silver bullet.
Yeah. And the other two are associated with vampires.
Right.
Yeah.
Although a werewolf is only a werewolf at during night. The full moon.
Oh, is it? Oh. When do werewolves transform themselves? During lunar eclipses, when there's a full moon, or whenever they feel like
full
it?
Full moon.
Yeah, right.
You can think of Lon Chaney Jr., and he's trying to be tied up so he doesn't, when he turns into the werewolf. And what is it, lanthropy? There's a term for becoming a werewolf. I watch a lot of old scary movies.
I think you're ahead of me. Yeah. What Halloween word do you think came from aghast, the root of aghast, struck with terror or shocked, and ghastly?
Oh, I was going to say ghastly until you used it in the definition. A ghost?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The German word for ghost, Geist, is part of the word Zeitgeist.
Huh. How about that?
Which literally means spirit of the time. What do you call a ghost that moves things around your house?
Poltergeist.
Yep. What brought Frankenstein's monster to life?
Well, a bolt of lightning, electricity.
Mm-hmm, lightning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which famous prince was Dracula based on?
Vlad the Impaler. Yes.
And finally, here's a question about, another question about Halloween fruits, and this is one I didn't know. Which of these fruits was the focus of Celtic Halloween practices? Cherries, apples, or pumpkins?
I'm going to say apples.
Mm-hmm.
And I only say that because when I was a kid, you bobbed for apples at Halloween carnivals.
And that's where it comes from.
Okay.
Because of their association with female deities, apples, and the pentagram shape appearing in their core upon being sliced in half. I've never thought about that as being a pentagram.
Haven't either. That's
apples
to me.
Were often the focus of Celtic traditions. Halloween activities like bobbing for apples, drinking apple cider, making candy apples, and handing out apples to trick-or-treaters comes from this Celtic ritual.
Hmm.
So have a happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to our militant grammarian, who is Catherine Sherrills.
Given the hold of racism in the culture, it's very possible that organizing white people would, at least at that point, been a difficult task. Because the attitude was that the white folks were so backward that we couldn't make inroads. And my view was, while that may be true, you still have to do it. You still got to try, you know?
With support from the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation and written and executive produced by Paul Kiefer, KUAF presents a new podcast series, The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas. This series traces the explosion of interest in anti-racist movements, particularly in white communities, and looks ahead to what this newfound interest might mean for the country. You can listen to episode one of this new podcast series right now at KUAF.com.
Tomorrow, the intersection of art and mathematics will be examined in a virtual lecture by Edmund Harris. Harris is a mathematician, an artist, an author, and assistant clinical mathematician in the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. His lecture, delivered by Zoom at 5:15 tomorrow, is sponsored by the University of Arkansas Honors College. Recently, we asked him for a bit of a preview of tomorrow's public talk.
So this is something that, dare I say it, we torture all high school students with. We don't look at what it means. We talk about solving a polynomial. We talk about, it's basically a simple set of equations. But what do those solutions look like? What can we learn about that process by taking a look, rather than looking at the equation as a written thing, which you have to process by thinking about it yourself? Can you present an image of those ideas? Now, this is obviously radio is not the ideal format to present an image, but you can take that equation that is seen by everyone and often regarded as a great way to waste students' time. But you can take all possible values or a range of possible values of those numbers, A, B, and C. And given those numbers, you get out two numbers. And what we can do with a list of two numbers is plot them, because we can use those as the X and Y coefficients. So on a piece of paper, we can think of horizontal being X, the X number, vertical being the Y number. And so now I've got a point. Mm-hmm. And I can just plot all those points. And it turns out there's a really beautiful structure to that. And you get an image that really anyone can look at it and they can see something interesting is going on there. It might motivate some people to study what that interesting thing is, and other people would look at it and be satisfied to move on. I mean, much the way that you can listen to Bach, and for some people, they tell that something's interesting is happening and then are quite happy never to listen to it again. And for other people, it inspires them to spend their life studying the intricacies of the music and all pieces in between. The same thing with the mathematics. You can see that something interesting is happening. Hopefully that motivates a little bit what mathematicians are doing, that other people might find this something worthy of study at the very least. So we took that idea and said, well, quadratic polynomials, the ones that are studied in school, are pretty well understood mathematically. But there's sort of layers of worlds on top of that that you can investigate. And you quickly get into places where there are big mathematical questions. With Steve Trettle and Kate Stang, we looked at more and more general versions of this and what happened when we plotted it and what could we see when we plotted it. And to be honest, our beginning investigation, and this was during a semester on illustrating mathematics at ICERM, which is a research institute at Brown, we had the space and time there just to say, okay, let's just make some pretty pictures. Let's just take this as a purely visual investigation. The only category we want to sort of think about is, do we like this picture? Is there something interesting happening in this picture? We're not going to ask, is it mathematically meaningful? Is it even, is it deeply aesthetically meaningful beyond just, oh, that's a pretty picture. I can show that to someone and they might like it. We then pursued these images through the summer, and we ended up submitting a paper that addresses some significant results of mathematics and significant and hard questions, and also provides an entry point to some of the geometry of these numbers that is accessible to people in a way, so maybe we're now talking about graduate students rather than the general public, but you can lead them into studying the geometry of these ideas in a way that might be sort of more obvious and intuitive than having to first build the picture in your own head and then be able to explore it.
Edmund Harris is an artist and assistant clinical professor of mathematics in the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. He will deliver a public lecture via Zoom, the lecture titled Perceiving Mathematics and Art. Beginning time tomorrow, 5:15 p.m., you can register online at honorscollege.uark.edu. We spoke with him recently about tomorrow's lecture. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Elm Springs. Timothy Dennis produced our show today. Contributors included Antoinette Grajeda, Daniel Carruth, and Jacqueline Froelich. Our conversations between John Brummett from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette and Roby Brock with Talk Business and Politics come to us through our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. You can learn more at talkbusiness.net. Our thanks to Catherine Churlds, our militant grammarian, for that Halloween conversation. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, new conversations with the militant grammarian begin airing on Tuesdays next week. Our theme is titled The First Hurrah. It is written and performed by Daryl Sean. Daryl can often be found around 4 o'clock our time performing live and taking requests on his Instagram and Facebook feeds. His most recent CD is titled Safe in Sound. You can find out more about us at either KUAF.com or OzarksAtLarge.com. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio in downtown Fayetteville, I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much. Please take care of yourself. We'll be back together soon.